FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. Today is November 15th, 2017. This year is almost gone. Where did it go? Well, a lot of good things have happened this year, one of which is a new book just published, just came out, hot off the presses 2 days ago, Bannon, Always the Rebel by Keith Koffler. Hey, and by the way, get involved in the show. Email us. I read them all. I respond to virtually all of them. Love to hear your comments. And don't forget the Twitter feeds at Kerry Lutz. So the book, Bannon, Always the Rebel, who would have thunk? Keith Koffler, you run the website White House Dossier, and you kind of have a good idea of what's really happening in D.C. So with that, we welcome you to the show.
Hey, thanks very much. It's great to speak to you, Kerry.
So, Bannon, obviously, you got to know him pretty well to write this book, authorized biography. Bannon is like one of those things, like your famous book, oft-quoted, least read. What was the most surprising thing about Steve Bannon in doing this book?
That's a good question. First of all, the only thing, it's actually not an authorized biography. He did give me access, but he did not authorize the biography. So I spoke to a whole bunch of people, some who didn't love him so much. But being a conservative and agreeing with him, there are definitely, it's definitely overall favorable treatment, certainly compared to what you'd see in the mainstream media. But it wasn't specifically authorized by Bannon. But he did agree to meet with me. And as we got rolling, we spoke for a very long time, 10 hours or so total. So he was very generous with his time, but it was also, mm-hmm. kind of a good meeting of the minds. I really enjoyed it. I guess the most surprising thing about Bannon potentially was, I was talking to one of his friends on background, and he told me that the thing that people don't realize about Bannon is how strongly his Catholicism plays in his life, how religious in a way he is. He's not necessarily a type of person who goes to church every week, although I know he does belong to churches, but he, Catholicism, the Bible have played major roles in his life, and see that in a couple of ways. As I go into more detail in the book, was a pretty heavy drinker at a certain point in his life. He says that, he was not quite an alcoholic. As he put it to me, I didn't have a drinking problem, but I didn't have a drinking solution. That's how he phrased it. And he realized at a certain point about 20 years ago when he was still in business for himself, that the drinking was getting in the way of his work and he needed to do something about it. It was just too much. Also, he was working over in Europe where they drink a lot and that was getting to him. And so what he finally did was he took lessons from some medieval texts of the Catholic religion by Thomas a Kempis, this famous work by him, and also by St. Ignatius. And what these volumes did is they give you a sense of getting away from your weaknesses, getting away from the mundane things that go on the world, and focusing yourself more on your life and what you need to do, and on praying and on God. And they give you, the St. Ignatius work gives you kind of a regimen for doing this so that, you do it in the morning, you do it in the afternoon. It's almost like a biblical 12-step program to getting your life in order. And he says that he started doing this immediately after he stopped drinking and that he hasn't stopped since. But he says that every day he practices these rituals, and that they have, without those tools, he could not have stopped drinking. So it's interesting that he took this approach and that Catholicism has that influence on him. And I just say one other thing about that is that I think, his Catholic faith informs his sense of fair play. I mean, he's a populist nationalist. So while he's a traditional conservative in a lot of ways, he wants to reorient the Republican Party more towards a working class party that benefits the working class class, the middle class, and tries to ensure that it's the elite are not taking too much of the pie and the establishment is not taking too much money at the expense of those who are doing sort of an honest day's work, sending their kids into the military and so forth. So I think it informs his thinking in that way as well.
That's almost a democratic ideal or notion that that we need to be helping the little guy, or at least not helping the big guy at the expense of the little guy. So he's really, he's really somewhat egalitarian. Does that go back to his background, or is it just something that he's come to believe over time?
I think it does go back to his background, and you're right. It is something that I think he hopes will appeal to some Democrats who, you know, the Democratic Party has become a party that really is about certain groups and about certain grievances and so forth, and less about the working class. And I think he wants to turn the Republican Party into a working class party. But it's less for him, I think, about redistributionism. And even though, you know, he was advocating a little bit higher tax for the wealthiest, but I don't think that's his focus. It's more the idea of keeping the United States out of these international trade agreements that he feels, tend to, especially the multilateral ones, that he feels tend to export jobs overseas at the expense of American workers, and also limiting the sort of unlimited immigration that we now have in this country. He's not anti-immigration per se, but I think he is anti-immigration, endless immigration from one culture, and he's concerned that that not only takes away jobs, but that kind of harms the culture that the middle class has had in this country for centuries. You know, that the American culture gets changed too quickly, becomes no longer a melting pot, but something different. And yes, in answer to your other question, I think, he's a middle class guy. He's from working class part of Richmond, Virginia. And his dad, you know, worked for the phone company for 40 years. And I think that that has informed his outlook. His dad also, during the 2008 financial crisis, lost a lot of money as, stocks went down. And meantime, he saw that the banks and the wealthiest were bailed out by the government, by government interference. And so, you know, while they were doing that, the question is, what was there for the little guy? And I think that this set Bannon on a course towards a more populist, nationalist view of how the Republican Party should conduct itself.
Right. And when you look back at the history of populism in the U.S., we go to the most notable populist, probably William Jennings Bryant, Democrat.
Sure.
The Democrats were always the populists. Mm-hmm. So how does he square being a Republican with being a populist? Because the perception is that the Republican Party is comprised of elite, of higher, higher income people. Whether it's true or not, that is the perception.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to square, right?
Yeah, I think that's what he is trying to do. I mean, I think he would view Reagan as a populist. Remember, Reagan was sort of an anti-establishment politician. You know, we view him as kind of an avuncular figure right now, but in 1980, the establishment, Gerald Ford, Henry Kissinger, people like that, they were horrified of Ronald Reagan and views him as this kind of rabble rouser with the people behind him that was threatening the establishment. So I think for Bannon that kind of populism goes all the way back to Ronald Reagan. And the thing that he wants to convince people is something that I think principled Republicans have tried to do for a long time, and that is that Republican policies are the ones that benefit average people. You know, you get too much statism, and you know, Bannon is by no means a statist, even though he is a populist, but you have too much interference by the state, and you end up having people on welfare, hooked on welfare. And that is, you know, there should be a message to populists that limited government and lower taxes and cutting the deficit are going to be things that are good for average middle class people. And that's the message that the Democrats have had for workers. It hasn't worked out for workers. It hasn't worked out for the country. And he wants to transfer that over and make the Republicans the protectors of the middle class.
Yeah, and so the Democrats, though, kind of cling to historical perceptions, maybe historical viewpoints, where they used to be at. They were the party of the little guy. I mean, going back to New York City, immigrants would come. You had Tammany Hall welcome the newcomer, help them find a new apartment, feed them, and then help them find a job. But that's not today's Democratic Party, is it?
No, it's not. It has really, and you know, Bannon, when he gets criticized as sort of this, you know, fascist, and when Democrats start playing all kinds of race cards and things like that against him and Trump, he tells me he loves it because he thinks that that is the type of thing that identifies the Democrats as a party that is representing, you know, trying to represent various groups and grievances and be a party of race and gender and things like that, and not a party of average people. And so, you know, for someone like Bannon, I think his calculation is that that average middle-class people still make up the bulk of this country. Most people just want to get married and live a decent life and get a decent wage. And the more Democrats talk about that kind of group politics and you know, whether it's ethnically or based or gender based, he feels that that puts them in a place where they're not going to win elections.
Well, look, you've got Maxine Waters. She's a, you know, she just.
I haven't got her.
Yeah, well, the country has her for better or for worse.
Yeah,
certainly California. But, you know, she's like California, bemoaning Trump, and she's lives in a $4 million home. She was voted the number three or four most corrupt member of Congress. The only thing she's got going for her is that she's an African-American woman.
Right, right. And she's willing to play the race card constantly and accuse people of horrible things. And there's a certain a constituency that responds to that. But for Bannon, you know, the more that Maxine Waters is on TV representing the Democratic Party, I think for Bannon, the better, because that says who the Democrats are now and that they are not the party of average people. And I'm talking about, or he's talking about, you know, not just average white people. Wasn't there a band? Average White Band.
Average White Band.
There was, I think, ironically named. You know, he says that he believes that the Republican Party needs to get 30% of the black working class, 30% of the Hispanic working class. And the reason is that he believes that these groups respond just like they're no different than anybody else. They want to have successful lives. They want their children to do well. They want to earn a good income. And so even the people in various constituencies that Maxine Waters and other Democrats are trying to appeal to, he believes will respond instead to this populist Republican message.
And the message really is one of opportunity. It's not shutting people out, but it's kind of saying, as one, I think William Weld, who was a former governor of Massachusetts, once said, that the government safety net should be a springboard, not a hammock. And
I like that. I've never heard that. Yeah. That's very good.
Yeah. So this is kind of what sums up Bannon is, look, the whole American dream. You work hard. You play by the rules. You honor your contracts and you take care of your family first, and you will succeed. And since the last financial crisis, I think the dream has gotten a bit tarnished. So maybe he's reaching back to a point in American history that many of you out there have forgotten about, that the streets really are paved with gold. You just have to do a lot of sweeping to get down to the gold.
Right, right. Yeah, no, that's very well put. And I do go into that in the book about how he views sort of cycles of history, and that we are in a cycle of history that is sort of a crisis period where things will come out one way or another. And he is hoping that it comes out, you know, it's not going to be exactly like the 1950s or 60s in terms of economic opportunity and some of the values that were, you know, pervaded then. But I think that he's hoping that on the other end of this crisis that will come out something like that, where just, you know, average people have a chance and the values of the country are not quite as far out in some areas as they are now.
Yeah. And well, I guess we're going to have to see how successful he is. On a scale of 1 to 10, how important would you say Bannon was to Trump's election as president?
That's a good question and a good way to put it. I want to say maybe a 7, but with this sort of caveat. I put it at a 7 because, of course, the most important person was Trump. And Trump is the one who got himself elected. He got himself through the primaries, as Trump points out, without Bannon. But I do believe that Trump would not have been elected president were it not for Bannon, because I think it was Bannon that kept him completely focused on this populist nationalist message, on this message that he is fighting for the average person and the working class, and that Hillary is the elite, the establishment, what needs to be changed about this country. And I think that is exactly what won him by relatively narrow margins, states like Pennsylvania and Michigan, as well as Ohio and some other states that put him over the top. So when I say a 7, I only mean that Trump was the main guy, but I think that without Bannon, he would not have won.
And it's interesting. So Bannon is there in the upper echelons of the campaign. And then you got Reince Priebus there.
Right.
The consummate insider, you know, head of the RNC. And probably in some ways as important or even more important than Bannon, at least in far as so far as winning the Midwest, the Rust Belt. So you got two guys who couldn't be more different. And Trump.
Yes.
Trump picked these guys. Right. I mean, in a way, they picked him, but Trump had to say, yes, I want them. They'll be a good team.
Yeah.
And if you're putting together a team, Keith, would you have ever thought of Bannon and Priebus together?
No, these are opposites. And you're right. And interestingly enough, they became relative allies within the White House because they were faced with people like Steve Cohen, who's top economic advisor, basically a Democrat, Jared Kushner, basically a Democrat, Steve Mnuchin, sort of a New York financier without the same principles. So in some ways, Bannon and Priebus, even though they're very different, they held more values in common than some of the other people there. And I think that, you know, they became allies. And Trump was very appreciative of you know, Trump likes people who work hard, and Priebus is one of these people who, you know, like Bannon and Trump, kind of never stop and are always going. And so I think that, that trio worked very well, Trump, Priebus, and Bannon.
Yeah. And so obviously Bannon was pretty much forced out, fired. Does he have any resentments about it? What's your take on the whole power play that went down?
Yeah, no, I don't think he does. And part of the reason is that it's not exactly that he was forced out. He was to some extent, but he was also kind of on his way out. He never really planned to work there for too long. As you know, as he put it to me, he knew that he wasn't long for the White House. He knew that it wasn't the perfect place for him, and that he'd eventually, you know, I mean, eventually he would get a lot of people angry. That was his nature. And also, you know, he's kind of an outsider, so he likes to work on the outside. He told me that when he took the job in August, and I go into this more in the book, that in August of 2016, running the campaign, that he figured he would be with Trump for about a year and then go back to doing the things that he was doing. I think he, you know, so he was looking to kind of get out and wrap it up. I think he would have stayed longer, but there were forces within the White House that were pushing for him to get out. And so finally, I think he acquiesced. So it was a little bit of both. And that's why there's not resentment, because there was a bit of a mutual agreement about it. And of course, as you know, people know, he still does talk to Trump on the phone, I think, quite frequently, and is able to give him fairly unvarnished advice.
And yeah, you know, that's what's always impressed me about Trump. I knew him a long time before he ever, at least in my mind, contemplated running for president. Mm-hmm. But this idea of putting together teams, and they're there for a discrete purpose, like Manafort. He was there basically because of his expertise in running conventions, and it threatened to be a very divisive convention. But Manafort, like, man, he pushed it through, no problem. They let Ted Cruz humiliate himself, and then it was off to the races. And that's just the way Trump seemed to be able to work it. So it's interesting. Mm-hmm. Does Bannon still consider himself to be in Trump's inner circle, if you will?
Yeah, I think definitely he does. You know, they talk, and you know, there's sort of an irony to it now in that he can speak to Trump without others in the room, because, you know, the way Trump works it is that everybody kind of goes home at whatever time, and then he gets on the phone and starts calling people and, you know, his sort of extended kitchen cabinet that he has, and asking them their opinions on things. And so in this case, without having General Kelly watching so closely or being in the room with arguing with Steve Cohn or someone like that, Bannon gets to talk to Trump directly. And so I think he still has a very strong influence on the president.
Yeah, I love the concept that if you get Trump, if you get him at the right time, you can get his ear and he'll listen to you. Whether he'll do anything, whether he agrees, he will listen to you. And that's what people don't understand about Trump, I think, is that he's always willing to listen to anybody regardless. And he'll do with it what he pleases, but he will listen. And, you know, that's a pretty amazing thing. So life after Bannon, we've got General Kelly running the show. Does Bannon have any views upon the current chief of staff?
You know, he was actually instrumental in bringing Kelly into the administration and getting him over at HHS. So they were friends. I think he is fine with Kelly. I don't think he has much of a relationship with him, but I think that he understood that with Kelly, you know, Bannon's office was just at the White House, was just two doors down from the Oval Office. There was only Kushner's office between Bannon's and the president's. And so he was used to just kind of wandering in and saying whatever he wanted to the president. So I think he knew that under Kelly, he wasn't going to be able to do that kind of stuff. So, you know, I don't think he has. I haven't heard him in the time after he's been in the White House saying anything particularly positive about Kelly, but nor have I heard him criticize him.
Yeah. Well, Kelly obviously brought something in there. Again, an example of Trump finding a guy for a particular job. Mm-hmm. How long he lasts? Hey, Washington is a grind, and it burns people out, it chews them up, and it spits them out. So anybody's days, you know, the day you take a job in the White House or a high-ranking political position, you should be counting the days till you're gone, because longevity is not one of the things that goes for a premium in D.C.
Yes, that's true. It's a rare person that can stay with in the White House for more than a couple of years. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Amazing things. So interesting times we are living through for sure. And you definitely want to check out Keith's book, wherever fine books used to be sold, right, Keith?
Yes.
Not
you
many
can find
bookstores.
It's on Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, and also on my website, whitehouse.ca.com. You can click to it there as well.
Great. And the title is Bannon, Always the Rebel by Keith Koffler.
Yep.
Keith, you're saying White House dossier. I've read it many, many times going back quite a while. Hey, thanks for coming on. And if you got any questions for myself or Keith, email me kl@carrylutz.com, Twitter feed @CarrieLutz, Facebook page Financial Survival Network. Keith, thanks so much for coming on. And we will talk to you again real soon.
That would be great, Carrie. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.